So that's the introductory reading and from Ecclesiastes chapter 2. And so we'll call upon our friend and brother Peter Lawrence to speak to us on the topic of modernism, postmodernism, and the believer. Peter?
Well, good evening, everyone. I've been having some internet troubles today with it popping in and out, so hopefully we last. So good evening. Thanks for tuning in, and hopefully this will be informative and interesting for you as it was for me. We've read Ecclesiastes chapter two here, and we can see in Solomon's musings, I guess, so to speak, as he writes this down, a certain emptiness. And I think as we look around the world today around us, perhaps there would be many that would echo this kind of hollowness of so postmodernism, modernism, they're kind of buzzwords which we hear from time to time, but do we really know what they mean? And more importantly, do we care? And hopefully by the time that we finish tonight, we'll be able to answer both of those questions. So in its simplest definition, both modernism and postmodernism are our worldviews, our ways of explaining life, explaining the world, explaining everything around us. And as the names would suggest, postmodernism comes after modernism. So let's start with a bit of history. And we need to start with the Enlightenment period, which I'm sure some of you have heard of, which happened through the 17th and 18th centuries. And two of the tenets of the Enlightenment period were they believed in the perfectibility of human nature, that human nature could be perfected. And they also believed that they believed in human progress and development through knowledge, through especially scientific research and understanding. So that was two tenets of the Enlightenment period, that human nature could be perfected, and that progress, human progress, happened through this gaining of knowledge, especially in the sciences. So that's the 17th and 18th centuries. Then later in the 18th century into the 19th century, we witnessed the Industrial Revolution. So there was incredible new technologies which were born out of that, tremendous opportunities, tremendous increase in wealth, in freedom. It's probably difficult for us to really understand what that would have been like considering the technology that we have now. But even those of us who are more than 20 even or perhaps as old as 40 like me, we didn't grow up with computers, and the idea of a cell phone is really quite revolutionary. So this, during this time of the Industrial Revolution, of course, things were changing very rapidly. And of course, this brought new ideas as well as all the new opportunities. So modernism really came to being in the kind of mid 19th century and into the early 20th century. And part of it was born out of the rejection of the bourgeois social structure, the class system. And it was a desire for new and better things as people were witnessing this new technology and all the incredible changes that were happening in the world, which really were unprecedented, had never been seen before. If we think of the 6,000 year time span of human history, really for the first 99.999% of it, everything was pretty much, and it's only really been in the last, kind of few hundred years, and even more incredibly rapidly now, things have changed very, very dramatically. And so modernism was born partly as a confirmation of the ideas that came out of the Enlightenment, and also partly as a bit of a revolution against this, the real kind of structured class system. Modernists wanted a more equal, a better way of life for society. So that's essentially then what, that's modernism. Of course, postmodernism in some ways is a parallel idea to that, and in some ways is an extension of that. So we'll explore that a little bit. So why do we even care? Why are we talking about the ideas of the world? Well, there are many, many verses, and I'll just go through a list here and I'll read maybe 10 or so verses of that God has given us warnings about the wisdom of the world. And so in order for us to even understand what God is talking about when he gives us these warnings, we need to be wise as serpents, so to speak, and harmless as doves in actually understanding the world around us and what sort of doctrines are out there. So if you're taking notes, 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 19 says, "For the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. For it is written, he taketh the wise in their own craftiness." All right, so we have a distinction here between God's wisdom, godly wisdom, and the wisdom of the world. John 16, verse 33, "These things have I spoken unto you, that ye might have peace. In the world you shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world." Mark chapter 4, verse 19, "The cares of this world, the deceitfulness of riches and the lusts of other things entering in, choke the word and it becometh unfruitful." So there's this conflict. This is an excerpt from the parable of the sower. Of course, when the sower goes through and spreads the seed. So cares of this world, deceitfulness and so on, which are things which are found in the world, are contrary to the believer and actually damaging and destructive to a believer. So another thing we need another reason why we need to understand things that are in the world. 1 John 2 verses 15 and 16, "Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world." So again, there's a warning from God for us to be wary, be separate from the things that are in the world. James 1, 27, "Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction and to keep himself unspotted from the world." Again, as we just read through, by no means is this an exhaustive list. There's all kinds of verses which warn us of the dangers of the world and to be separate from the world. Ephesians 6, verse 12, "For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places." Philippians 2 verse 15, "That ye may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God, without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom ye shine as lights in the world." So of course, then there's a distinction between light and darkness, and the world being full of darkness. And finally here, Romans chapter 12 and verse 2, "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect." So as I say, there's many, many more verses beside these, but I just wanted to give us a number of them just in a big block, just so that we understand the reason why we would even bother considering a subject like this of modernism and postmodernism and worldly theories and philosophies. We are reminded, we are exhorted, we are instructed on so many occasions in Scripture to be separate and to be wary and to fight and to be prepared against these things. So it's critical that we actually even know what we're fighting against. So we're going to go through now, we're going to talk about some of the kind of the points of modernity, of where modernism came from and the kind of the tenets of modernism. So since the middle of the 18th century, kind of really beginning in Northern Europe and of course spreading to every corner of the world, people have become aware that we are living in an age which is radically different from any other, and which we've called with a mixture of awe and respect, trepidation and nostalgia. We call this the modern age, or more succinctly, modernity. We are all now inhabitants of modernity. Every last tiny, even remote island has been touched by the outlook and ideology of this new era. So the story of our emergence into this modern world can be traced in a number of fields, in politics, in religion, art, technology, fashion, science, all of which have ultimately contributed to an alteration of consciousness. It's a change in the way that we think and feel. And this is some of the things where, or what it means to be modern or in modernity. So secularization is one of the big ones. Perhaps the single greatest marker of modernity has been the loss of faith, the loss of belief in the intervention of design forces in earthly affairs. All other ages before the modern age held that our lives were at least half in the hands in the hands of gods or spirits who would be influenced through prayer, through sacrifice, and all who kind of required this complex form of obedience. But in the modern age, we put our energies into understanding natural events through reason. There's no more omens or revelations or curses or prophecies. Our futures will be worked out in laboratories, not temples. Even the nominally religious will, when it comes to it, defer to highly trained pilots and cancer specialists. God has died and modernity has killed him. So that's something interesting to think about, how the world is so secular. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read a couple of these, or I'm going to read a kind of a paragraph and respond to it with some scripture, just to show how off, the reasoning, the wisdom of man is. So Psalm 53 verse 1, I believe it's actually Psalm 14 verse 1 is the same verse. It's a Psalm of David. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Corrupt are they, and they have done abominable iniquity. There is none that doeth good. So that would be God's response to modernity's trying to get rid of him. So another important idea that comes in modernism is the idea of progress. So pre-modern societies envisaged history in cyclical terms. There was no real forward dynamic to speak of. One imagined that things would always be as bad or good as they had ever been. There was no more change in human affairs than there was in the seasons. Empires would wax and wane. Periods of plenty would alternate with seasons of dearth, but the fundamentals would remain. Yet, to be modern is to believe that we can continually surpass what has come before. National wealth, knowledge, technology, political arrangements, and most broadly, our capacity for happiness seem capable of constant increase. We have severed the chains of repetitive suffering. Time is not a wheel of futility. It is an arrow pointing toward an essentially perfectible destiny. I think that's an interesting thing. And again, it's maybe a challenge for us to understand just how drastically different that would have been from those before the modern period to now. It seems as though we only ever think in a progressive type of direction, that things will change, things will improve, things will get better. We can learn more. We can advance, where in times gone by, that just, it wasn't really the case. There was no end in sight, so to speak. It was just kind of this circular life cycle. I think what's interesting is that with that, as a rebuttal from a spiritual perspective, is that the very foundation or at its very core, the idea of progress is actually structured on discontentment and on greed, essentially, to progress. And of course, our verses for that would be 1 Timothy 6, verses 6-8, which says, "But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of the world. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content." So the idea of progress coming out of the modern age is in itself discontented. It's a kind of a greedy idea and attitude of always moving forward for more. So another aspect of modernity is science. We have replaced gods with equations. Science will give us mastery over ourselves, over the mysteries of nature, and ultimately over death. Careful calculations and electrical pulses in microscopic circuits will allow us to map and know the universe. It's only a matter of time before we work out, at least, the clues to our own immortality. I think that's such an arrogant statement of modernity, of this idea of modernism, that we can find out everything, that eventually we will overturn the curse of Eden through science. So a response to that from Isaiah 55 and verse 9, "For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways and my thoughts than your thoughts." We have no chance ever of understanding the mind of God and overruling the laws which he has set in motion. Individualism is another aspect of modernity. To be modern is to throw off the claims of history, precedent, and community. We will fashion our own identities rather than being defined by families or tradition. We will choose who to marry, what job to pursue, what gender to be, live, and how to think. We can be free and at last fully ourselves. Christ. So this idea of individualism is, of course, not acceptable in the eyes of the disciple. So here's another one, the idea of cities. We've had enough of the languor and judgmentalness of village life. We don't want to go to bed when the sun sets or limit our acquaintances to the characters we went to school with. We want to move. Along with 85% of the population of modern nations, we want to move into brightly illuminated cities where we can mingle in crowds, surreptitiously study faces on underground trains, try out unfamiliar foods, change jobs, read in parks, learn about abstract expressionism, rethink our hair. So this idea of cities and gathering together, I think, harkens back probably to the Tower of Babel, when mankind thought that they would gather together, you know, and build this tower up into heaven. And it contrasts with many of the kingdom pictures that we have. And so if we read from Micah chapter 4, verses 3 and 4, says, "He shall judge between many peoples and shall decide disputes for strong nations far away. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. But they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree. No one shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken." And I think this idea, certainly many of these kingdom pictures, as we suggest, are not the idea of living in massive conglomerate cities. I think God has intended us to be a lot closer to nature. To have our own vine and our fig tree, to understand where our food comes and so on. And I'm not suggesting that we should, you know, rebel and move out into the middle of nowhere. And unfortunately, many of the things that we experience in our lives are perhaps necessary evils. But I think the ideal that God has designed us for is not to be gathered together, in these massive human edifices. In regards to nature, pre-moderns lived in close proximity to nature. They knew how to recognize shepherd's purse. I would not know how to recognize shepherd's purse, nor would I be able to make something edible out of pineapple weed. They could tell when the sparrows showed up and what sounds short-eared owls make. They venerated nature as almost a mighty deity. But moderns don't tremble before the night sky or feel a need to give thanks to the rising sun. We have freed ourselves from previous awe at natural phenomena. We are alive to the sublime technology rather than of waterfalls. The emblematic modern locale is the 24-hour supermarket, brightly lit, teemed with the produce of the four continents, proudly defying the barriers of geography and of the night. We will eat pomegranates in August and dates in February. So I think this is, again, another example of just really trying to throw off the confines or the restrictions of the natural world that God has created for us. So a few of these I don't have verses particularly for, but just to give us a sense of really the ideas, the ideology of the world around us. Speed is another interesting consideration. For most of history, the maximum speed was set by the constraints of our own feet, or with a lot of luck, the velocity of a horse or a sailing ship. It might take 3 weeks to tramp from London to Edinburgh, 4 months to sail from Southampton to Sydney. In 18th century Spain, the majority died within 25 kilometers of where they had been born. Now, nowhere is further than 26 hours away from us. I think that's pretty interesting that we can literally go anywhere in the entire world within 26 hours. Well, maybe not now because of COVID, but you know, at one point. So nowhere is more than 26 hours away. The contents of a national library can fit onto a circuit the size of a fingernail, and the Voyager 1 probe hurtles at 17 kilometers per second through interstellar space, 21.2 billion kilometers from its original blue dot. It's just, I think, remarkable again for us to consider these types of things, which we take for granted that no other time period in history could really even conceive of. In relation to work, we are modern because we work not only to earn money, but to develop our individuality, to exercise our distinctive talents, and to find our true selves. We are on a quest for something our ancestors would have thought entirely paradoxical. Work that we can love. Again, just interesting. So much of the transformation to modernity has been profoundly exciting, thrilling even. Fiber optic cables ring the earth. Satellites guide us through the darkness. New ideas overthrow stifling conventions. Cities are conjured from the ground, and colossal energies are unleashed by the Promethean forces of chemistry and physics. The word modern still suggests a state of glamour, desire, and aspiration. But from another perspective, and this is where we'll slightly change gears, the advent of modernity has also been a story of tragedy. We have bought our new freedoms at a very high price indeed. We have perhaps never been quite so close to the collective insanity or planetary extinction. Modernity has wreaked havoc on our inner and outer landscapes. We can pick up aspects of the catastrophe in a range of ideas. So this is where, you know, we've talked about previously all the grandeur and all the great things that people have aspired to with modernity. But as that last paragraph mentioned, there's a tremendous cost. And for all man's wisdom and for all the greatness that he preaches and is his vain show, the proof is in the pudding, so to speak, of the futility of his efforts. So here's a few examples of where modernity really is quite terrible. In the idea of failure. So it was the French late 19th century sociologist Emile Durkheim who first made the sobering discovery of an essential difference between traditional and modern societies. In the former, when people lived in small communities, when the course of one's career was understood to lie in the hands of the gods, and when there were few expectations of individual fulfillment, at moments of failure, the agony had limits. Correction did not seem like a verdict on one's own entire value as a human being. One never expected perfection and did not respond with self-loathing when mishaps occurred. One simply fell to one's knees and implored the heavens. But Durkheim could see that modern societies exacted a far crueler toll on those who judged themselves to have failed. No longer could these unfortunates blame bad luck. No longer could they hope for redemption in a future world. To a horrifying degree, it seemed that if there was only one person, it seemed that there was only one person responsible and only one fitting response. As Durkheim showed in perhaps the largest single indictment of modernity, suicide rates of advanced societies are up to 10 times higher than those of traditional ones. Moderns are not only more in love with success, they are also far more likely to kill themselves when they fail. And I think this is absolutely tragic, really. This idea that failure is so abject in modern societies, and because we place so much value and importance on our own identities, failure becomes such a tremendously difficult thing to deal with. And that's one of the downsides of modernity. Now there was a term invented or coined in the middle of the 19th century called, let me see if I can pronounce this right, neurasthenia. And it was a term to describe a distinctive malady of the mind felt to have been bred by the modern condition. So this idea, so in the modern age, there was this condition, also known as American nervousness. It was associated with living in cities, with being shaken by crowds, overstimulated by newspapers, exhausted by choice, cut off from nature, and driven frenetic by expectations. And I think we can probably all relate at least to a degree with some of these conditions. So this was such a stark difference from pre-modern societies that they actually created like its own disorder, and they actually named it. And I think that probably describes, I wouldn't even begin to imagine what a huge percentage of the population now, what's the word we would use? Anxiety probably would be a catch-all for what we would explain it today. Multiple cures were offered back in those days in the mid 19th century. Cold baths, compresses, walks in the country, mild electrocution, tight belts around the midriff, a vegetable-only diet, special socks made from llama hair, and long periods of silence, all to deal with this anxiety. To be modern is to be assailed at all times with the news of every latest government fiasco, of every beheading around the world, of every film premiere, mass shooting, lasagna recipe. Anything to have happened anywhere around the world in the preceding minutes, we are bombarded with. We're always connected. We're always aware. The average 12-year-old has access to 200 million more books than Shakespeare. The last person who theoretically could have read everything died no later than 1450. We are exhausted. I think that is something that is only increasing. It is only getting worse now with our cell phones and our devices in our hands. We're just overwhelmed by stimulus being pounded at us at all times. And this is a real tragedy, if you want to say, of the modern period. talking of nostalgia, modernity, so keen to wipe away all that came before it, has unleashed a torrent of nostalgia. Never before have so many longed to live in an age other than their own. And that's an interesting concept. While benefiting from modern dentistry and communications, they have nevertheless dreamt of absconding to a castle in the time of Charlemagne, or a stone cottage in the days of King Arthur, or I guess probably a frozen castle with Elsa, with Disney. Modernity has bred elaborate fantasies of simpler lives on South Sea islands, in Native American teepees and Arabian medinas. These longings might not be actual plans for real world action, but they're telling ways of letting out a sigh at the depredations of this whole era. I think that's interesting too, the idea of escapism and how many movies and novels and all this, and you know, stories and poems are all seeking to escape from this so-called great modern world that we've created. Envy is another huge one. Modernity has told us that we're all equal and we can achieve anything. Boundless possibility awaits every one of us. You know, we too might start a billion-dollar company, become a famous actor, or run a nation. No longer is opportunity unfairly restricted to a favored few. It sounds charitable, but it's a fast route to an outbreak of comparison and its associated pain and envy. It never would have occurred to a goat herder in the 17th century to envy Louis XIV of France. The king's advantages were as unfair as they were beyond grasp. Such a peace is no longer possible. In a world in which everyone can achieve what they desire, why don't we have more? If success is merited, why do we remain mediocre? The psychological burden of a so-called ordinary life has become incomparably harder, even as its material advantages become ever more available. I think that's another interesting thing in this freedom to achieve and to be whatever we want to be. The envy of those who do better is just, it's unbelievable. And I think we see this really, really clearly in so much of the social unrest that we see today in the news. Loneliness. Modernity has, in a practical sense, connected us to others like never before, but has often left us frequently emotionally bereft. Late night, on our own, in a corner of a diner, like a figure in an Edward Hopper painting, staring out at the darkness within and without. The belief that we deserve one special person has rendered our relationships unnecessarily fractious and devoid of tolerance or forbearance, and stripped friendships of their value. The first question we are asked in every new social encounter is, what do you do? And we know how much an impressive answer will matter. We fall asleep in high-rise apartments with views onto the distant headquarters of banks and insurance firms, and we wonder if anyone would notice if we died. And what a depressing but also accurate description of the world we live in, where people are just so lonely. There's just so little meaningful connection. Although we appear to be friends with so many people, the reality of true and deep relationships is unfortunately very scarce. All right. So as time progressed on from the inception of modernity, the goal of modernity or modernism to improve the lives of humanity and to free us from the oppression of these ruling classes, to create a fair and an equal society, progressing on through scientific discovery into perfection and even immortality, it began to show its cracks. With these obvious failures and following on from the tragedies of the First and the Second World Wars, in the late 60s, postmodernism began to take hold. In some respects, postmodernism ran parallel to modernism, with each setting out to accomplish the same goals of a better, of a more fair, of a more equal world, although with some significant differences. Both sought to end the class system, but differed on how to accomplish it. And in many other ways, the two are quite different, with postmodernism focusing on the inherent futility of mankind to direct his steps, so to speak. And of course, Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 23. O Lord, I know that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man that walketh to direct his steps. And I think we know that. I think it's been proved over and over through all of history that we are really incapable of running our own lives and running the world. In many ways, postmodernism is a nihilistic view of the world. It recognizes the failures and, in fact, the impossibility of modernism to bring about the bright, beautiful future world that it promised to deliver. Now, you might think, like, why am I even talking about this? Why is this a lecture topic? Who cares what these people out there think? Unfortunately, we don't have the luxury to be indifferent to these ideas, because postmodernism is fully entrenched in the education system. So if you have children, or if you're going to school, we need to understand this. It is fully entrenched in the social sciences and humanities. It's fully entrenched in governments, in corporate HR departments and policies, in corporate news media. Postmodernism is the gospel of this world. It is the wisdom of this world. And like those from any age, we must be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Now, it's not to say that postmodernism is worse than any other of man's ideas throughout time, but it is the current darkness that we must be ready to defend against. So let's explore some of the ways or the teachings of postmodernism as a contrast to modernism. And in a way, postmodernism is extremely difficult to describe, because fundamentally, as part of its core, is that the world is subject to the perception of the individual, meaning your view of what postmodernism is could be quite different than mine. And that's postmodernism in a nutshell. And obviously this makes it challenging to describe. So probably the biggest tenet of postmodernism is the view of truth. Now, where as a modernist would believe that the truth is out there and it can be discovered through scientific discovery and through discussions, postmodernists believe that there is no such thing as truth. Nothing is objective, only subjective. There is no good or bad. Nothing better than something else. Everything is value. All the data that science can accumulate and can and is somewhat healthy and whatever other particular categories that I can fit in. That's the only way that I can interpret the world, is through my particular lens. It's only my truth, and it is not yours. And in some obscure, tiny way, there is a glimmer of truth in that our personal experiences most certainly do impact our perspective. I don't think there's any question of that. But where a disciple and a modernist would agree, would both reason that through open and through honest discussion, that we should be able to determine what is truth based on, based on that exercise of exploring. But a postmodernist claims that you cannot come to any sort of truth. It is impossible. You cannot possibly understand the perspective of another person, because you are not them, full stop. You can only act as an agent of your particular identity. So the idea of free thought doesn't exist, and therefore free speech cannot exist. It's not a question of whether it should be allowed or not allowed. It's that it doesn't actually even exist. You're only ever an agent of your identity group. And in addition to this, as a result of truth being subjective, every idea that is held is only ever constructed by the society around us. Gender is constructed, is a social construct. What we view as healthy is a social construct. Everything is just made up by society. So anything that asserts something that is true, anything that purports to have some sort of truth behind it, it must be destroyed. It cannot exist. So I think this is a dire state of the world around us. So a response would be John chapter 8, verses 31 and 32. So Jesus said to the Jews who had believed him, "If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." So this is a dangerous statement to a postmodernist, the idea that something could be true. And this truth, as we know from the word of God, can set us free from the chaos and the madness of modernism and postmodernism. So we definitely are witnessing the evidence of this postmodern theory, especially on university campuses where certain lecturers, people come in to speak, are shut down with riots. But increasingly beyond the universities, there's growing censorship in the media and on social media platforms. There's children who are going through gender reassignment surgery, and definitely unhealthy lifestyles are promoted as healthy because why not? You can make up your own truth. And to continue on from that, almost to the point of bizarre, is that even the idea of science, which might provide evidence to counter these some of these ideas, it's rejected by postmodernists. They claim that science itself is simply a tool, and it's weaponized by white males. I guess most scientists are white males. That's maybe why, but it's a tool of oppression by white males against whoever they decide to oppress. So without our faith, I think things like this would be extraordinarily concerning. I think that would be pretty worrisome. It is worrisome to think that this is where the world is going. But of course we have our faith and we know that things are actually in the hand of God, thankfully, and not in the hand of modernists or postmodernists. So the point of this is not to make us afraid, but to expose the folly and the futility of man's endeavors to guide himself without God. So where modernists' view on individuality differs from the postmodern, modernists took art and books as though they were unique creations of the creator, of the artist. They were thought to contain deep meaning. As technology progressed with computers and internet, many copies of these works were made. And postmodernists ceased to believe that these works contained the one individual meaning that the authors or creators intended. Rather, that meaning was to be discovered by the individual who viewed the works based on their group identity. I think that flies in the face of what we read in the scriptures. Galatians 1 verse 8 and 9, but though we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel unto you than that we have preached unto you, let him be accursed. As we said before, so say I now again, if any man preach any other gospel unto you than that which we have received, let him be accursed. So that's what God thinks about interpreting things for yourself and taking out of it what you can. And of course, 2 Peter chapter 1 verse 20, knowing this first, that no prophecy of the scripture is of any private or personal interpretation. So postmodernists also reject the idea of a grand narrative or an overarching narrative that all societies should band together and follow. So unity and common goals like progress, like scientific progress and freedom, those are to be rejected by postmodernists. Instead, diversity is celebrated. This thinking was the result of the two great wars, the First and the Second World War. And the idea that if nobody shares a goal like nationalism, like a country, then there'll be nothing to fight about. Seems to me like that's throwing the baby out with the bathwater, but that's all right. So what does God have to say about the idea of a higher power and something we ought to follow along with? Acts chapter 2. Verses 42 to 47, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and the prayers. And awe came upon every soul, and many signs and wonders were being done through the apostles. And all who believed were together and had all things common. And they were selling their possessions and belongings and distributing the proceeds to all as any had need. And day by day, attending the temple together and breaking bread in their homes, they received their food with glad and generous hearts, praising God and having favor with the people. And the Lord added to their number day by day those who were being saved. So I think it's a very different picture than the idea of this individualism and diversity, which is preached in postmodernism. God has asked us to belong to his plan and to his purpose, and that requires setting our individuality aside to be a part of his plan. And Ephesians 4 verses 1 to 6, I therefore, a prisoner for the Lord, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, not whatever you want to make up. There's one. Just as you were called to the one hope that belongs to your call, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. This is not a matter of our own ideas of whatever we can come up with. There's one God and he's set up the plan for us. And so as a result of this sort of futility in postmodernism, which sees all the efforts of modernism failed, there's no meaning in the life of a postmodernist. And so we see the rise of activism and protests. A postmodernist attaches to a cause, not so much because they believe in it, but because they have nothing else. In an empty, in a void life with no purpose, with no truth, with nothing higher, no higher power, nothing to follow along with, you latch on to many of these causes which we see in the world around us. There's no conversation. There's only causes. And so to fill the void, the emptiness in your spirit, in your soul, you join up with one of these causes. So with no truth, there's no right or wrong. There's no individuals. There's only groups. We have no common goal. We have no direction. We have no purpose in our lives to unite us. And yet there is this staggering inequality. Both the modernists and the postmodernists sought to address this inequality, and both thought that their ideals would lead toward more equality, when it turns out that their ideas have only resulted in the opposite. And so because the postmodernists don't believe in any of these ideas, if you do not believe that, say, hard work is better than laziness, or if you don't believe that some ideas are better than others because everything is equal, if you don't believe that some things have more value than other, if the world is just so differentiated, then the only reason that can be left for inequality is oppression. It's because someone took it from someone else. And that's, I think, what we're seeing coming more and more to the surface now in the world around us. And so I think it's going to be very interesting to watch and just to see how far God will actually let this madness, the madness of this age, let it continue, and to what destruction he will allow this world to suffer based on some of these ideas before he sends his son back to earth again. And so to conclude, postmodernism sees in the world's wars, in the utter failure of modernism, the failure of human reason and intellect, the failure of science, the failure of progress, the failure of the individual, the failure of capitalism. That's what postmodernism sees all these failures. While modernism was a confirmation of the views of the Enlightenment, postmodernism is a rejection of those views. In a sense, all the postmodernist sees is failure and futility, vanity, if you will, and perhaps Solomon was the first postmodernist. I had to read that Ecclesiastes chapter 2 again, but we'll just have to maybe go back to it in our minds that Solomon, in all his wisdom and everything that he tried, every bit of learning and study that he did, every bit of building that he did, every bit of pleasure that he sought, all he could conclude with at the end was that it was vanity. So we will finish with one verse, and it is also in Ecclesiastes, and it is at the very end of Ecclesiastes, perhaps at the very end of Solomon's life. And his conclusion after all of this, after all the ideas, after everything that he could come up with in all of his wisdom, far superior intellect than any of the modernists or postmodernists, Solomon says, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man.